This episode is made possible in part by Donate Pizza, where dough does good. I recently had an episode with Angelo Corso, and he's been partnering with at least 50 pizzerias in the city, and collectively, he and his volunteers are able to donate pizzas, quality pizzas, some of them are even gluten-free and vegan, to the homeless shelters in Chicago. If you're interested in donating or volunteering your time, please check them out at donatepizza.com. That's DoughNatePizza.com. Cheers. This episode is made available in part by Chicago EMT Training. As an EMT, you'll gain the ability to recognize and manage any medical illness or traumatic injury. It's one of the best ways to get your feet wet in healthcare. You can be working alongside techs, nurses, PAs, physicians, paramedics, and firefighters. Chicago EMT Training hosts a class every fall, spring, and summer. Visit ChicagoEMTTraining.com if you're interested. I am Consciously Curious, a podcast for those that are searching for a career or cultivating meaning within their own space. We've had anesthesia providers to barbers, dog behaviors to airline pilots, white collar to blue collar, entrepreneurs to passion projects. Life's too short to not produce meaningful work. Join me, Victor Chan, as we deep dive within various industries. I'd love to hear your feedback, so feel free to leave a comment. I hope you find some value within these conversations, but more importantly, I hope it sparks a meaning within your own space. Our next guest is the current medical director for the local animal rescue, One Tail at a Time. She shares some of her experiences that led her to pursue veterinary medicine, and specifically shelter medicine. We even explore some conversations around adoption and what pet owners can do to keep their fur babies healthy. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Rachel Wooten. Dr. Rachel Wooten Schendel.
Yes.
Is that how you go by now? Or
yeah.
Since you got married?
Professionally, still Dr. Wooten.
Okay. Gotcha.
Socially, Schendel.
Schendel. Okay.
However it works. Yeah.
Okay. thanks for making the time. It's been maybe even a couple months since the career fair that I met you at. I loved hearing you speak on the panel. And I haven't had the chance to speak to a vet in this capacity. I have been thinking about this conversation recently because within the last month, I have two dogs. Ooh. We've been at the vet maybe 5-6 times. He's still on a cone.
It's
coming up on a month. He had an oral hematoma.
Yes.
And the first surgery did not work.
No.
It came back. And so the second one, the doc said, it's not going to look as aesthetically pleasing, but I think it'll do the job. I'm like, whatever will fix
You're
it
like, at this point. We don't care.
So I've been like, man, perfect timing, I guess. It's a coincidence that a doctor of veterinary medicine is coming on. How are you? How has your 2024 been? How long have you been in the industry for?
Yeah. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here. 2024 so far has been going really, really well for me. The past couple of years have been life-changing. Mm. I had a daughter. Mm. She is almost 10 months.
Okay.
So it's been, like I said, life-changing experience,
yeah,
just
absolutely.
Learning how to do both. But it's been incredible. Every day is a new day. And being a vet was, those were the initial goals of my life.
Okay.
And so answering your question, I've been in the field since 2017
okay.
is when I graduated.
Awesome.
So it's been a little bit now, which
yeah.
is crazy because sometimes I still feel like a baby vet. But I'm definitely come into my own these past, 6.5 years?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and it's incredible. The field is everything I had hoped it to be, a little bit more than I thought, a little bit less than I thought, but I'm sure we'll get into that.
Just on that cusp of comfort and challenge.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
It also, the other coincidence is one of our cousins, my wife's cousin, is one of the fosters for One Tail at a Time.
Oh, really?
Where you're the medical director.
Yes.
At. So it's very, very fitting. I hope he listens to this.
Who does he have? Do you know?
I met the pup once, but he's fostered probably like 3 or 4 dogs.
Amazing.
Already.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
And sometimes foster to adopt.
Yes. Our favorite foster fails is what we call them. And I'm like, is it really failing? A little bit.
At what point, it's hard not to love animals, but at what point did you kind of realize that this might be the industry you're going to fall into?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was since I could talk.
Okay.
Is I wanted to be, as my family told me lovingly, how I couldn't pronounce the word, but I wanted to be a vegetarian. so that they say that happened around two. And, you know, from there, it's always just my parents have always kind of instilled in me, yeah, you can pursue this. You can go, even though they had no idea how to get into this field.
What were they?
So my dad is a music producer.
Oh, wow.
So very different than medicine. He's a music producer, very skilled. Most of my family on that side is in music.
Okay.
And then my mom, she's in business, but she was a stay-at-home mom until we were around, I would say, like, I was in eighth grade or so.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, and so she came from Puerto Rico, and so it's always kind of been, like, I loved animals, and then it was kind of fostered by my abuelo, who had a farm in Puerto Rico. We would go there every year.
Every year?
Yeah, we would go there to visit him for most of the summer.
What kind of animals?
So we had horses, chickens, pigs, farm cats, dogs, you know, everything, you know. And yeah, so he showed us, like, how you kind of take care of them. And he was self-made, so he just did everything on his own. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it was slowly me, oh, can we have a cat? Can we have a dog? And my dad, he loves animals as well. So it was kind of like they fostered that love of my and that passion of mine.
Sure.
But then it was, you know, they really were like, hey, you know, school is really important. Education is very important. You want to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a career option that you can do, be with animals and go that way. And I think that's where it was like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. Yeah.
Okay. So like you kind of like all in, did you feel like you had any backup plans or this is like, I'm gunning for this?
So, I mean, really I was gunning for it, but like, yeah, back of my head, of course there was like, okay, if I don't get into this, what can I do? Forensic science like came about for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was really like, well, maybe I'll just be a human doctor.
Mm.
That was another option. Or I was thinking about teaching a little bit.
Is there a lot of overlap with prereqs?
Yeah. So veterinary school, you don't have to, like, it's kind of like pre-med prereqs.
Yeah.
There's, for vet school to apply, you have to just take a certain amount of science credits and prerequisite courses. And then you take the GRE.
Okay.
Yeah, there's not an MCAT
for
vet school. There used to be, but they got rid of it. They're like, we don't really need that specific of a test, and it's the GRE. So you can really go and do almost anything with that.
Do you feel like that's has had any effect on the quality of candidates for vet school?
I think it gives them the option. So some of my classmates were English majors before vet school.
Wow.
You know, I think it's really nice that you don't have to be like a biology major, or you could do music. You could kind of go with your other passions.
Well-rounded
as well.
Vets then.
Sometimes, I mean, a majority of us are type A science.
Sure.
We made it here this way, but yeah, we do have a diversity of veterinarians as well, which is nice.
Do they, or I mean, maybe this, you know, depends on the program, but like look at certain extracurriculars, like how easy or how much weight do they put on experiences like becoming a vet tech or maybe even volunteering at a shelter?
Yeah. So it's kind of changing. Everything is kind of changing the field. I don't want to say a crisis, but somewhat of a crisis, the vet field.
Shortage or?
Yeah, like we have a big shortage of veterinarians right now. And we have a very high suicide rate among veterinarians.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so it is an interesting aspect.
Where does that stem from?
So I think it stems from a lot of things. So I believe it's probably like a lot of our field, like there's a lot of compassion fatigue in our field, which I'm sure you understand within the medical field as well.
Yeah.
But It's, we come in with a lot of debt. Like, the cost of veterinary school is not cheap. Mm-hmm. And so we're coming in with, I mean, $300,000 a vet going into this field.
Yeah.
And then we're not valued the same as human doctors, even though we have the same, like, educational background.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the just pay to debt, income to debt ratio is just...
Yeah.
Not sustainable.
So what, it's maybe difficult to get a life started, whether it's mm-hmm. applying for a mortgage loan or
yeah, lots of things like that. And then aside from that, the medicine has just gotten better, which is incredible for mm-hmm. our patients, but it's expensive.
Mm.
And I'm sure, as you know, taking your vet to the doctor multiple times is expensive.
Yeah.
That every pet owner does not have.
Right.
And so then a lot of guilt gets put on the veterinarian and the veterinary staff about, like...
By who, though?
I think it's a lot of both. I think it's both. So there's some self-imposed. There's some people who can't afford the care will say, like, you should help us because you like animals, you know?
My God.
You know, like, free health care.
Sure.
Which, of course, if we could...
Yeah.
Trust me, we would happily just be able to treat your pet and... you know, go about our day.
Yeah.
But it's just not a reality. And I think the hard part is within the industry, it's in human medicine, we have insurance that takes up, you know, you don't have to pay at
right.
upfront. You can make monthly payments. That's not as accessible in veterinary field because one, when you try to make payment plans, people kind of just burn you. That has happened. So okay. a lot of vets have stopped doing that. But then also insurance just hasn't been like, it's getting more popular now, but it yeah. is not where it needs to be. And I think what we need to do more as a field too is be advocating to go to the insurance companies and talking to them about how can we fix this? Because still right now, if you have pet insurance, you have to pay you have to pay your bill up front
and
then they
reimburse
you, which is still like, not really possible for a lot of people. So it's hard. And I think all of it comes down is you see an animal suffering. So then I'm going to internalize that because I can help, but I can't help.
Yeah.
So it's a mixture of a lot of things.
I didn't know that. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
That's rough. And it's, I hope people have a different, or maybe at least empathize with the situation.
Mm-hmm.
While on the topic of, insurance, is there a type of plan within pet insurance that you would recommend or build if it doesn't exist for the average pet owner?
So I don't have like a great, like the best understanding of it all.
Yeah.
'Cause I do work in shelter medicine. So
gotcha.
I don't really deal with clients and owned pets as much as like a private practitioner
sure.
or the ER vets
sure,
and things
sure.
like that. But I mean, specifically something I would like to see is like, yeah, we make like right now how they're kind of built is their monthly payments.
Yes.
And then if something happens, you take your pet to the vet,
yeah.
you pay that bill and then you submit for reimbursement from your
right.
insurance company. I just feel like if they can pay the bill up front mm-hmm. or pay whatever portion they're supposed to pay to the hospital directly, it would help a lot more people
mm-hmm.
And be something more that we should be fighting for.
Yeah.
Because then clients will be able to like benefit from their insurance a lot more.
And say yes to more things that
yeah.
their pet might benefit from.
Yeah.
I didn't read the fine print when I first got insurance, but it didn't include, you know, prophylactic, you know,
yeah,
annual
it
checkups.
It does not. Most plans.
Most don't.
There
might be some now that do, but they're, yeah, most don't. And it's just like, you know, when your pup is at 5 months to a year, not too many things went sideways. But
yeah.
That being said, you know, especially with the latest, you know, event with the oral hematoma, some friends chimed in the sense of like leading up to the later stages of their pup's life.
Mm-hmm.
The bill could be upwards of like, you know, $15,000-$20,000.
Oh yeah. It's like, it's, yeah.
Where the insurance might pay off at that point.
Exactly. Which, yeah. And that's like the hard part is like, I Like, I'm still just like, yeah, you should get pet insurance now. To anyone who asks me, you should just get pet insurance because you never know. You just never know. Like, there's certain breeds that I'm like, you have a lab, they're going to eat something. I promise you they're going to eat something you do not want them to eat. You should get pet insurance. Because it is, and that's that, and that's why I say, like, like veterinary care, medical care is expensive. Mm-hmm. And it is more expensive than the average person can afford.
Yeah.
Especially in an emergency. Like, we're asking people now, hey, do you have $5,000 just to spend right now?
Yeah.
For a surgery to save your dog's life because they ate a ball.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's really important because you, the, like, people love their pets. Like, this is not,
it's not an easy decision.
Yes. Yeah. It's not that they don't. And the pets are now, as we see more and more every day, part of the family. They are not what, you know, used to be.
Right.
Like, oh no, that's my pet. No, this is my daughter. Like, this is my son. This is my firstborn.
My daughter.
Yeah. You know, like, this, like, people openly say, like, I mean, I have my daughter Nellie now.
Yeah.
But my first daughter was my cat Navidad, and then my son is my dog Link. And
yeah.
They
what, what percentage of the photos in your phone are comprised by our cats?
Yeah, like, now, like, it used to be all my dog sleeping on my cat sleeping. Now it is a lot more Nelly, but, you know, it is. It is. They are your family.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that's what's so important. That's, like, what really drew me to, like, shelter medicine, too, is because of access to care is just so sparse, especially in Chicago, too. And, being the advocate for the animals who don't have an owner was important to me in school. And then as I continued to develop, it turned into, like, oh, hold on. Look at all the people on this side, too.
Mm-hmm.
And shelter medicine is kind of the forefront of trying to help bring access to care and veterinary care to under-resourced areas. And just, like, being able to be a part of that was really important to me because then it kind of turned into more like, okay, I made it. I'm a vet.
Mm.
Now what?
Mm.
Like, you know, my goal was accomplished at, I don't know, I was 24 when I graduated or something. You know, like, and it's just like, where do we go from now? And what do I want to do now?
Sure.
And so, it's about helping people.
To, I guess a side note is I am always grateful for the vet not, making me feel guilty or shaming me for saying no to certain things.
Yeah.
And they don't even ask why, but I think it's like helping us make an informed decision.
Yes, exactly. And that's what it's really about.
Yeah.
And I think it's the line that we, you know, struggle with sometimes, but especially, like, in my side, with access to care and veterinary medicine in lower income areas, like, it's all about incremental care. Okay, where can we meet you now?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the vet field has to go, in order to continue to do what we want to do. And that is meeting the pet parent where they are and saying, these are the most, like, important things. And maybe it is talking about, like, yeah, we can do these diagnostic tests and maybe we'll tell us the answer. They cost X amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment is going to cost this amount of money. What should we do? What do you have that we can work with? And let's see what we can take out. Like, I think it's really important, especially when talking with a pet parent too, is never to just assume anything. Like, I should never assume you can't afford something. I should never assume you don't care about your pet to do this.
Right, right.
And I think these little implicit biases and judgments happen all the time, not only in veterinary medicine, human medicine. And it's those types of things that we really need to look within ourselves to determine how are we
showing up for our,
for our patients every day and showing up to our clients as well. Because as much as people say, like, oh, I went into veterinary medicine because I don't like people. Well, this is a very people-centric field.
Yeah,
so it's
right?
really not as, like, just animals as we would probably some people hope it is.
Yeah.
And so it is interesting being able to, like, I love talking to the clients. Like, that's, it's fun for me. I'm a very extroverted person who I mean, I enjoy hearing their family story when I can.
Yeah.
But that's not true for everyone. And so it is important just to kind of make sure you're laying it out for them so everyone feels comfortable with what's happening. And then also still being able to care for the pet. Because if we just say, oh, well, they declined all of these diagnostics, I can't do anything.
Not giving up, right?
Yeah. Then it's like, well, we didn't help anyone in this situation now. And they leave feeling defeated and like probably ashamed that they can't provide the care for their pet. Even though they want to. And I kind of look at it when we see clients and patients, it's just, well, you're here now. So what can we do today to help?
Yeah.
And I try to take my day by day like that.
So, I guess along the same line, are there certain locations in the city for people that might be looking for treatment that can't afford it? Yeah. They might have to wait a little longer, but are there places like that?
There's definitely some low-cost like animal hospitals. They're not a lot. There are not a lot. But there are programs as well that people can reach out to. So some are not even in the city. And I think that's really hard, like transportation, public transportation. You can't bring your pets onto public transportation. So there's a lot of barriers to care that we need to address. But at least at One Tail at a Time, we have our Pet Mutual Aid is a part of our organization where we have like food pantries for pet parents. We're starting some community medicine. We do large scale vaccine and microchip clinics. And then aside from that, we are also part of the coalition with a couple of other shelters. And we are running, it's called like a crisis care program. So it was really built to be like shelter diversion program to stop. Cause a lot of people will relinquish their pets to like Chicago Animal Care and Control or any other shelter because of not being able to afford care.
Sure.
And so they know, well, if I bring them here, they will get some help.
Right.
And so it's really about keeping the families together, keeping that family unit together. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to give up their pet for care because of that. And so we have a program, you can use it once. And it's just for financial need if you need it. You don't have to like prove anything, but if you express that you need help, as long as you're within the city limits and everything, we're able to provide care. We'll send you to one of our partner clinics and, you know, we will have you contribute whatever you can contribute. And then we help try to do the rest of the bill. So,
nice.
And that's called CRISP. Chicago. I always mess up the name. It's like, oh no. It's Chicagoland Rescue Intervention. Oh, I'm getting in trouble.
Okay, but
CRISP. Yeah, CRISP. I will send that to you later.
Well, yeah, we'll put the link in the show notes. Going back in time a little bit, like, what do you think were some things that helped you stand out on your application? Was it more competitive when you applied back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, I would assume
just due to the shortage, right? I'm assuming that it's not as competitive now because of the shortage,
which is hard to say. I feel like there's still a lot of veterinarians there's still a lot of students coming into the field. I think the issue is actually the veterinarians who are leaving the field early. So a lot of people are leaving clinical medicine at 5 years.
What? Because of the burnout?
Yeah. Because of burnout.
To do what?
Some other aspect. Some are saying in the field and doing like a different aspect of medicine. It's not even medicine. Like, you can go into politics, you can go into teaching, you can do government work
within like the pet realm, I guess.
Yeah.
Like government, politics, all that within the pet realm.
Yeah, kind of. You can work for pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
In the food industry.
Teach. All that stuff. That's kind of what I'm doing actually.
Exactly. You know, you like kind of pivot just a little bit.
Okay.
And I think that's like what's really exciting about the vet career is that you don't, like, everyone thinks of a veterinarian, you think of practicing medicine.
Yes.
But it's so much more.
Okay.
And so like I do appreciate that aspect of it.
In an ideal world, would you think they would probably want to do both? Hold on to that, some of the clinical aspect?
I feel like in an ideal world, yes. I feel like most of the people who burn out, there's like corporate, there's like so many things causing burnout in veterinary medicine, but
so it's seen as a very romantic kind of industry.
Yeah.
Right?
And then the harsh realities of of it.
Do schools try to be transparent with the realities?
I think now we are.
Okay.
So, and that's why I think it's like ever changing. Sure, we're also trying to increase diversity within the field. I mean, there's the statistic a couple of years ago was 2% of veterinarians are Black.
Yeah.
I think about 4% are Hispanic.
Said on a previous podcast, I've never heard of HBCU. I had to look that one up.
Yeah, Historical Black College University. So Tuskegee is where I went to vet school. And the first and only HBCU to have a veterinary school.
Wow.
That is no longer going to be true. HBCU in Maryland is opening a veterinary school. They just got approved, so that's really exciting. But it's just... I mean, at one point, of course, that was the only place Black people could go to vet school.
Now, was it wow.
Back in the day.
When you went, was it still pretty diverse or dominantly Black and brown? Or
yeah, so it was, I mean, it was a pretty good mixture, I would say. But yeah, it was definitely probably a majority. I'm trying to think for sure.
Yeah.
It's almost 60-40.
And what it stems from a fear of not being heard and seen at other places?
Yeah, I think it's like a mixture. Heard, seen, fitting in.
Yeah.
A lot of times you're just looked over as well. Wow. Your application could just be looked over.
Okay.
And
you don't, or you don't want to get accepted due to a quota.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, because that's always the, you know, that's the misconception too of...
Yeah.
Like, no matter what, your accolades got you there, but someone is always going to say, well, they probably just got in there because they needed diversity. And like, how does that feel to the student?
Oh my God.
And not only that, like, I'm sure you know as a teacher, like, there's ways teachers teach.
Yeah. Yeah.
Students.
Yeah.
That they think, and that's just a bias, that an implicit bias usually. There's like research in psychology showing that if you think someone doesn't belong, you teach them less.
Mm.
And so if we like always were taught like, oh, well, we have to reach quotas, we have to reach diversity quotas, or affirmative action is the reason why these students are here. The teachers are going to teach that student differently, whether they mean to or not.
Mm.
And that's the sad reality. So I mean, I think it's a mixture. Like, I mean, I'm very happy I ended up at Tuskegee.
Right, right.
It gave me a new sense of confidence in who I am, especially after growing up in predominantly white neighborhoods and schools through my whole life. So being surrounded by people who look like you and who are excelling is incredible. Yeah. And so, like, thinking of that is just, it's the norm for white Americans.
Right. They had the luxury of not having to think about it.
Yeah,
right?
You know, and you don't really realize it until you're kind of surrounded by your own people.
Sure.
That, oh, wow.
And they're thriving.
This is different. Yeah. this is just a little different. And I mean, I loved University of Wisconsin too. You know, it's just different. But yeah, people do excel in different environments. So I don't know the question. Like, I don't know the answer. Like, is it because...
Yeah.
More Black students and more minority students apply to Tuskegee? Is it just...
I don't know. Like,
they're applying other places maybe as a well sense and of not heritage getting in. And,
but if you can remember, like, what did help you stand out? Or, like, for someone reading your application, how do you convey your love of animals and your desire to help sick animals?
Yeah. I think what helped me stand out, because answering your question, too, about how to... weighing veterinary technician degree before applying and things like that. I think I stood out more, honestly, because I had such a diverse background of animal experience. I did not work in a clinic before. Mm-hmm. I did shadow veterinarians, and I did, you know, have some hours in that aspect, but I did research with animals, and that was part of my experience. And I worked at a zoo.
Is that... something that most vet programs look for, like kind of like pre-med, like they're all looking for research and
not all looking for research. I think it definitely helps. Absolutely. I mean, academics especially, like,
wow,
we're always looking for research.
Is that hard to find an animal research lab?
So no, because I went to University of Wisconsin, and they have a veterinary school there. Oh. And so they just, you know, like I did look when I was applying to undergrads, I did look for schools that had a veterinary school. And then an animal science track.
Yeah.
Cause then you just knew animals were on campus and things like that. I don't think you necessarily have to
have
animals.
Who told you to do that?
I just did it.
Okay.
Or maybe my parents did. I'm not positive. I'm not 100% sure, but
that's good. That's good. Keep going.
I think just like research is just research in different ways. So like it doesn't have to be hands-on animal. Like my first research lab was with cow DNA. I was not touching cows or doing anything. I did another research project with robots because I wanted to see what that was going to be like. And they chose me actually to be one of the students on the project because of my animal background, as they were trying to make robots admit like nonverbal social cues.
Mm.
And their research question was, do people who own pets read nonverbal cues better than people who don't? Which is
what'd you find?
It's true. They do. And so like, cause of course you're talking to your dog, you're reading what they're doing.
Which goes back to the high burnout rate is, I think you just empathize and sympathize more with animals because they can't really, speak to you, but you still feel so much for them.
Yes. Yeah. It's hard. Yeah, exactly. And I think like that might've been what kind of they attract. Cause I was a different student.
Okay.
Like so many come in with clinical experience and that's what they do.
I have a feeling you did these things for the sake of doing them, not because it was going to add another thing on your resume.
Yeah. Like a mixture.
Mixture. Okay.
Yeah. Like definitely I was thinking about my resume.
Okay.
But also, yeah, I wanted to pursue something that I was interested in too.
Sure.
I mean, I think if I knew, like, I didn't really know about veterinary technicians.
Mm.
So, like, I didn't know that was an associate's degree that you can get and become a veterinary nurse and then go through, like, some people work through undergrad as a veterinary tech.
Well, okay. But that's an associate's.
Yeah.
So what is that, two?
2 years.
That's a 2-year program.
Yeah.
So,
and some people in Illinois, you don't have to go through a program. You could work. You could just go and work and learn on the job. And you'd be a veterinary assistant.
Okay. Okay.
So like there's like different things.
Wow. What experiences or things are they looking for to just even get your foot in the door in that veterinary assistant position?
I feel like a lot of the times you first come in as you're cleaning kennels. So like you're literally helping the veterinary nurse, so the veterinary tech.
Okay.
And so you're probably cleaning, like a kennel attendant, cleaning kennels, helping answering phones, like the receptionist might start and get your foot in the door in that way, and then you slowly get pulled back to learn the other skills.
Gotcha.
I feel like a lot of the technicians and assistants that I work with now have learned on the job.
Are these paid positions?
Yeah.
Because it's almost like that's kind of like what a volunteer might be doing too.
Yeah, and that's the hard part. And that's another part of burnout in our field. Or just like, how do we get more diverse candidates from different walks of life? Because so I'm very blessed. Like my parents supported me in my dream.
Yeah.
And they had the means to do that. Because when I say I did an internship at Brookfield Zoo during my junior to senior year of undergrad, wow. That's unpaid, 40 hours. Everyone cannot do that.
Right, right.
That's not a reality.
Right. You had the support,
You know, I had the support of my family to help me do that. Another position I did, completely unpaid. A lot of animal experience, especially as you're growing and as like an 18-year-old or something like that, they are going to say, well, you could volunteer with us. If there's not a position open, there's nothing they can do.
Right.
Or you can't work. Like a lot of clinics need full-time individuals. So like trying to do school and be full-time, that's not feasible either. And that's a reality that I think we need to change in our field, is we need to pay individuals for what they're providing to us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I mean, especially at the shelter, that's where a lot of my animal experience came from.
So then what would a volunteer be doing then? If those assistants are doing what I thought a volunteer might be doing?
Well, at a clinic, it's a little different.
Okay.
You probably wouldn't have volunteers so at a clinic.
Like volunteers at shelters typically.
Would be helping us do those things.
Gotcha. Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha. Sure. Gotcha.
And they're invaluable.
Yeah.
I love my volunteers. We could not do what we do without volunteers.
Right.
And they do. They help provide enrichment to the dogs and the cats in our care. They help walk the dogs. They help clean the kennels when we need them to. Yeah. They help us do laundry. You know, I mean, and that's different. Like, we're a nonprofit. We're a shelter. We have staff to do, you know, take care of the day-to-day, too. But these things, like, to make sure the animals get as much enrichment as they do and get to go on super long walks like they do, is because of volunteers. And especially, like, we're a foster-based rescue, too. So we have less in, like, staff actually on site in facilities because we don't have as many animals as, like, Chicago Animal Care Control does on site every single day. And I mean, technically, I guess fosters are volunteers, so.
Yeah.
Right.
What were some memorable experiences at Tuskegee?
At Tuskegee? Oh. Let's see. I loved Tuskegee. One of my favorite memories is probably, I mean, there's just so many. I love that place. my classmates are, they made my experience.
Okay.
We really were a great class. We all got along for the most part and
helped
each other out.
How big was it?
That was one of the great things about Tuskegee. It's smaller class sizes. We were 70 students. University of Illinois, which would have been my state school, is, I think they're up to 140.
Wow.
So double.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite experiences at Tuskegee is really the junior surgery experience that we had.
Okay.
And just the actual being able to talk with the clinicians firsthand, because we are so small. I knew the surgeon, like we talked about the case together. My mentor was, you know, the internal medicine doctor there. She helped me present my, Dr. Martin, she's incredible. And she helped me present my, grand rounds case.
Okay.
And like went through like my presentation. Like she had the time to do that with me. Like, I don't think you get that everywhere. And you know, like the shelter medicine program was small at Tuskegee. But we called her Granny. That's what we called her. And she was one of the clinicians there, Dr. Montgomery. And she was, you know, older and like, she was just like, no, I'm everyone's granny, you know, like, and it's that type of family.
Sure. I like that.
Bond, you know, and that's, I mean, culturally, I feel like that's at HBCUs in general. It's family. It's for us, by us, you know, like we're going to get there. But she, you know, she made sure I found ways to find other experiences. Dr. Guy made sure I found ways to get an experience that you needed. And Dr. Guy was very big on finding paid opportunities for us when we had to go in our fourth year. Cause in fourth year you go and you do externships. So you go away from campus for part of the year and learn experiences in other ways. You should like go to different clinics or, things like that. And she made sure she's like, here's a list of paid ones. Like, these are the ones you should try, you know, because she knows, like, even us vet students, like, how can we go?
So then would you be going as
paying?
What's that role? Like, as an assistant or as a resident? Or
you're kind of like you're a student. And so it is kind of like we're going to have some this year. I say they're kind of like an intern.
Okay.
You know, like they follow the veterinarian around, depending on the clinic you're at, depends on the doctor who's mentoring you, how much, like, I like to go, okay, like, pretend, or you are the doctor, it's not pretend, because in a couple months you are the doctor.
Nice, okay.
Go in there, do your exam, tell me what you find, and then I'll come in, and I'll do mine, and then we'll discuss what's our next steps, and I'll tell you how that
feels real
is.
When they're there by themselves.
Yeah, like, you know, like, I'm like, you can do this, and it's about building that confidence, and like, you know, it's okay.
And this is is vet school 2 years, 3 years, 4 years?
4 years.
4 years. So is it year between three and four, or?
No, it's during your fourth year.
Okay,
the first 2 years are more didactic learning.
So we're in med school, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then dependent on your school, the third and fourth year, Tuskegee was like half and half, so okay. half clinical, half didactic.
Okay. So fourth year.
And then fourth year is basically
they're
clinics.
Good to go, essentially,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. And then, I mean, that's why I say, like, it's just, we can come out of vet school and start practicing right away. But if you want to specialize, so you want to be a neurologist, you want to be a surgeon, you want to be board certified.
What's that like?
You're most likely doing a rotating internship.
Through another program? Or
yeah, so there's like, it's called VEMCAS. It's like this, you put in your resume, you rank programs that you would like to attend.
Okay.
You do interviews with them.
Wow.
And then, yeah, then you, you know, you match.
Okay.
So you match to see where you're going to end up going.
Kind of like residency.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so, like, usually it's an internship first. So, like, let's say, because I thought about being a surgeon, so I kind of know that. Internship first, most likely. Then, because it's super competitive, you probably either have to do another internship or try to get a specialty internship or some type of fellowship. And then, after that, it's a three-year residency.
Wow.
So, it's probably still another 4 to 5 years before you are out practicing and making money.
Wow.
Like, really making money, you know. And that's still, like, not enough money.
So, what do some vets do in order to fill the gap when they feel like they've been established? Maybe like entrepreneurship or become a vet social media influencer.
Yeah,
like, what is it?
We have those. And I'm like, oh my gosh, should I dabble? But all of the above.
Okay.
So some go into practice ownership.
Okay.
That's kind of hard right now. Corporate medicine, like large corporations, are really kind of taking over the vet field.
Wow.
Which is kind of causing more burnout. It's like this never-ending cycle. But but some do, and some do this incredible, and you know, they own multiple practices or they have their own practice standalone and they have that. Some have side businesses. Some do something completely outside of the field if they have to supplement care. Like, it's just sad that if you would have to.
Right.
You shouldn't have to.
You
like,
should
especially
just
with
want
a doctorate,
to if you wanted to.
You know,
right.
like, exactly.
Yeah.
You would expect not to have to. But yeah, that is a reality for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's tough. And especially like if you love this shelter medicine aspect, but the money isn't there, it's just like, what if you're forced to just open up your own?
Yeah, I mean, and that's some of it for some people too. Like, I'm sure a lot of people would like to go and specialize and follow their one true passion within this field. But the reality of, like, my internship, I did a specialty internship right out of graduation in shelter medicine at the University of Illinois. And I mean, I think my salary was $24,000.
Oh my God.
And I was a doctor at that point. So, like, knowing how much school costs, and then, like, the reality of, like, if I decide to continue that route, I mean, the resident doctors only make maybe $10,000 more than you. So that's for 3 years of...
3 years? Is it, like, 60-hour work weeks, or what are we talking?
Yeah, I mean, they're insane work weeks, too. You know, like, so, like, it is taking a beating. So, like, that is why I think, too, like, a lot of people are like, I'm not going to do that. I can just go and work right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing is, like, I can learn surgeries. Like, that's where I ended up going from shelter medicine and surgeries. Like, I know I can learn, and I could do surgery. Like, I love surgery. Shelter medicine gives me the opportunity to work with the animals who don't have a voice, who I wanted to advocate for.
As well as
community medicine. So now I get the people aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a lot of surgery.
Yeah.
A ton of surgery, especially like overpopulation of animals, decreasing that. So a lot of spay neuter. But then we're the only chance these animals have. So if I'm willing to try, I can do these complex surgeries.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of soft tissue surgery. I do amputations. Like, I do a lot of surgery. I mean, I don't do orthopedics, and we send to our incredible partners who we do work with, but it is nice that I still get to
that's a lot.
Do my passion.
It's wide
as well.
Ranging. It keeps things interesting, right?
Yeah, like nothing's the same. Every day's different.
Was there anything about shelter medicine that you were maybe delightfully surprised by or just didn't see coming?
I would say the community medicine, community aspect. Okay. That was not where I thought I was going.
Did you feel like you'd end up in Chicago?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, well, my family was here.
Yeah.
So I definitely was gonna come home. But my boyfriend, now my husband, he lived here.
Okay.
So I was definitely coming back. We did 8 years. We were high school sweethearts.
Amazing.
And nice. So we did long distance.
Oh my God, yeah.
For 8 years. Oh. He's a saint, Nick.
Congrats to that.
He's a saint. Yeah, like he never told me I couldn't do it. I mean, if he did, it would probably have been, we would not be together.
Right.
But he was always so supportive. And yeah, he made sure, like, because he went to Illinois, I went to Wisconsin, so 4 years there, and then I moved to Alabama.
Sure.
And that was like the true test. But so it was always like, come on, like make yourself back home.
And I mean, how often did you see each other when you were interning?
Yeah.
Here, right?
Yeah. Luckily, so Shelter Medicine was a little bit nicer to me than my counterparts who are my really good friends who were doing the rotating internship. They definitely were doing more closer to 70-hour weeks. My schedule is a lot nicer. My mentor made sure of that. He was really good. So, I mean, I was probably doing closer to 40, 45 hours.
Yeah.
But not really ever more. So,
And
the weekends, like, I would get some of, like, those off and whatnot. So
sure.
He gave me a chance to, like, see ER if I wanted to. And, like, but so it would either I'd drive to Chicago or he would come to at least it's closer than Alabama, so we got to see each other a lot more that year. But then he was like, yeah, we should probably come home. And I was like, I'll make sure to find a job there.
I guess one thing I should have started with is just like the variety of the spectrum of animals that you can be responsible for. It's pretty wide, isn't it?
Yeah,
most people just think cats and dogs, right?
Most think cats, dogs.
Okay.
I mean, right now, and I mean, that's in vet school. When you go there, you will learn all species. So the big four are cat, dog, horses, cows.
Whoa.
Yeah. So those are like a lot of your, that's like your main curriculum. Those are the big four. Then you got pigs. I mean, guinea pigs, rabbits, exotics.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, then it kind of depends on what you want to do. So some schools track in school. So if I know I want to do
I can.
I will end up taking more large animal courses. Or if I want to do small animal, you go that way. Or if there's a zoo or exotic, it just kind of depends on your school. Tuskegee does not track. You have to do all of the rotations. You have to learn.
Oh.
Yeah. Which I thought was good.
Like you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I really think that's kind of, I like that a lot better. I know, like, if you get to be more specific on your training, of course, like, you will probably be a better clinician in that area if that's where you end up going. But you don't know where you're going to end up. There's so many equine veterinarians who come back to small animal medicine later.
What's equine?
Oh, horses. Sorry.
Oh, okay. How do you spell that? E-Q-U-I-N-E?
E-Q-U-I-N-E. Yep.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah. So like equine, bovine. Bovine is cows.
Oh, like okay.
Gotcha. Scientific term.
Great.
Feline. But yeah. And so like, you just never know where you're kind of going to end up. And so I really enjoyed just learning it all.
Absolutely.
Like I was like, this is probably the only time I'm ever going to do this again.
Yeah.
So why not just take that opportunity?
Did you ever like get swayed into one direction?
Well, I did think when I was growing up, I was like, you know, I want to do dogs and cats mostly, but I think I would like to do horses too. So I really thought I was going to do mixed animal medicine.
Sure.
And then I learned more about horses in school and I was like, I think they're better pets. I'm good. Like I do not need to go by them anymore. And yeah, so like if I didn't go through that experience, like how would I have ever known?
Right.
And if I did have to track at first year, I could end up having to do a ton of equine medicine that I'm like knew I didn't want to do anymore. I don't know how easy it is to change.
Yeah,
track,
but that sunk
but
cost.
That
yeah.
could be something that happens.
Oh wow!
And I mean, I really didn't think I would do exotics, but here I am at one tail at a time.
We have
rabbits, guinea pigs, and we had a bird and. Like I am the veterinarian there, so if there's a question.
Yeah.
I did learn it. All right. Okay. Well, let me see what I can come up with, you know? So, and I'm open. Like, I know my limitations.
Sure,
I wouldn't
sure.
ever harm an animal just to do something, of course. But,
yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, like, we do have to be conscious of how much money we spend outside of the clinic. So
sure.
we can't send every exotic just because I haven't touched them since school. So now I've brushed up on my rabbit medicine, brushed up on some guinea pig medicine, and we're able to keep it moving. And the other veterinarians there too have their experiences. So,
right.
Yeah. It's that's the nice thing about the field is you don't have to get sandwiched and put into a box.
Yeah. Yeah.
No matter how long you've been here.
Okay.
Like, if you really want to do something else, you are licensed,
you just keep learning.
You can keep going.
Okay.
Yeah.
What part of One Tail attracted you? What about what part of their model?
One Tail
pulled you in. Yeah.
Like,
where you shop? Like, you know, like Chicago, definitely. Now, where within Chicago are we going to go?
Yeah. So I, right after my internship, I actually went to Paws Chicago first.
Okay.
And I was working there for 2 years before being approached by One Tail.
Mm.
And I really loved One Tail's model of being a foster-based rescue.
Okay.
I hadn't worked at a rescue that was like that. I'm used to more brick and mortar shelters. So that means most of the animals are housed in house
mm-hmm.
before they get adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really exciting to be able to do something. But I think what really attracted me to them was that they were growing. The clinic was only opened in 2020. So
I did not know that.
One Tail at a Time is actually is a pretty young organization. 16 years now,
okay.
we just hit. Yeah, it was just opened in 2008 by a couple of friends who saw a need at Chicago Animal Care and Control.
Okay.
And from there, they were like, well, we're going to help. Like, we're going to rescue animals out of there by just fostering them. So they would just go into foster homes and, you know, that was it.
Yeah. Kind of a facilitator then.
Yeah, and like, we help find them a new home. It's really important, and that's how sheltering works. And it's so important that we have partners and like other organizations who can help, because
it's hard to do it alone.
One place can't do it alone.
Yeah.
There's no way. I mean, and so they opened a clinic, and that was really exciting. And then knowing, like, because it's so brand new, I was the second vet hired there. Having a voice and the care that was going to be provided was really important.
Yeah.
And like, for me, it was really knowing the difference that I would be making in the lives that came into One Tail's care. And then after being there a little bit, what kept me, I would say, is that, you know, they're advocates for what they believe in. I really, like, my values align with One Tail's values.
Mm.
Like, rescuing, like, there's one of my favorite things they say is, it's not rescue if they already have a home.
Mm.
Because I think a lot of people can get lost in like, well, we have to rescue this animal. We have to take this animal and we're going to send it to a better home. And it's like, it's already in a home.
Mm.
It's already in a home that it's very loved in. Let's find resources and care and help this family unit stay together and help this family unit take care of the loving member of their family. And it's very no judgment. And we're here to help.
What is it most commonly, a financial thing?
Yeah. Financial thing, education.
Education.
There's like lots of different things. Why we see some of the cases we see.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say education and lack of resources is like one of the bigger issues.
Mm.
Yeah.
With, a lot of my close friends know this, but now the public will know this. It's a lot easier to get a dog than you think.
Yeah.
I walked in for dog food on like National Adopt a Dog Day or Adopt a Pet Day. And, it's the Anti-Cruelty Society on Canal.
Yeah.
I saw that. I was like, they're waiving all adoption fees.
Yeah.
And did a lap and then walked out with a dog.
And you were like, oops.
What?
And
they're like, your roommate's cool with this? My roommate was in the Philippines at the time. I'm like, yeah, he's cool with it. Oh my goodness. And, you know, I would never relinquish care of that dog. And I'm super grateful that my first one, who's reacted to certain dogs, they get along. So I'm very lucky that that's the case. But you do hear a lot of like, you know, you get the dog and then you just find out you can't take care of the
dog. Like, you don't know what to do. Yes. And like that's I mean, that speaks to like why One Tail I really liked it is because they have open adoptions like this. It's there are some places that I cannot adopt a dog. As a veterinarian, if I filled out their application and said all the things that they wanted, like you have to have a backyard, you have to own your house.
I did see places like that too. Hurdles
and obstacles and barriers.
Because the end goal is, you know, to minimize return, right?
Yeah, but is that really minimizing returns? I feel like probably not.
The barrier's too high.
What you're really minimizing is your adoption pool.
Yeah.
And you're minimizing all the people who have great homes and open homes to take these animals in that, like, it's still a sad reality. Shelters have to euthanize for space.
Mm-hmm.
So we are just stopping homes that are willing to take an animal in because it's not the quote unquote perfect home.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean? Like I could have a dog. I could be a person who has a yard. If I just let my dog stay in the yard the whole day, is that really a perfect fulfilled home?
Dog? Yeah.
Is that really the, just because I check all the boxes.
Interesting. Yeah.
So yeah, it is easier to adopt a dog. And I think looking at the rescues or the shelters that you adopt from and kind of seeing, like, will they take your dog back is important to me. What if something did happen and you had to move, I don't know, and you couldn't take your dog with you?
Yeah.
I know anti-cruelty will take your dog back.
Wow.
And, like, they'll help you. And that's really special. But that's not the reality for a lot of places. So, like, when I was looking at new employment opportunities, and why I stay with One Tail is because they are progressive in these decision making. Honestly, they're also willing to change too. Like if I have a different perspective,
sure.
They treat me as more than just a vet, which is what a lot of places struggle with. They see the veterinarian as the veterinarian and they could only do medicine, but forget the individual that's behind that.
So they impose a lot of rules and protocols, and
I think that
kind of limiting.
Leads to some burnout.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I'm much more than just being a vet, you know.
Absolutely.
And it's important for you to be able to work your brain in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't include veterinarians in the decision making policies that do directly affect the way they practice medicine or just directly affect their lives, getting like part of a person.
It's like the owner or like a non practicing person is dictating these things?
Like sometimes. It depends. It depends on where you're at, you know, you don't know. And like when you hear it, when you say it out loud, you're like, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
But that is a reality of our field.
Right, right. What are some common things that people should know on pet care or some common things that you see with people bringing their pets in that they could be doing prophylactically to minimize that, maybe?
Table food is not for pets.
Okay.
Yes, you can give some. Of course, we love our babies and we want to give them. But it's really the seasonings and things like salt. The way dogs and cats digest food is different than humans. Our digestive tracts are different, so they do not process it the same. And that's why a lot of fatty foods like bacon or something like that can cause pancreatitis.
Mm.
Or we just get diarrhea. I was reading an article actually just recently, and it's really, why do pet parents bring their pets in for diarrhea so frequently? Whereas, which is a little gross, but when you get diarrhea, you usually don't run to your doctor immediately. You usually probably wait it out or see, you know, what's going to happen.
Right.
But when your dog has diarrhea,
people start.
It is like, oh my God, we got to get in. Like we need something because think about it. This dog is in your house. I use the toilet.
Yeah.
Oh no, he might use your floor.
Right. It's a mess.
Or
yeah.
Like if I have to run to the bathroom a couple times in an hour, I know it's going to end soon. I have to let my dog out a couple times every hour.
No, it becomes an annoyance.
It's a lot more life altering, I would say. So like,
gotcha.
If we can find ways to avoid them getting diarrhea or cleaning their ears. You know, you could get a generic ear cleaner and clean their ears every once in a while. A lot of dogs don't need it, but some dogs do. There's probiotics that are over the counter that can sometimes help with the gut flora.
What about dental hygiene?
Dental hygiene. I was about to go there. That is like a really big one that I think we try our best to do a good job on it. But I think being able to show pet parents, like, yeah, you are supposed to brush their teeth every day. I know that's hard. And for some animals, it's not feasible. But if you actually pay for the dental cleaning with your vet once a year, how you go to the dentist once a year, you will actually save more money because they will not lose a lot of their teeth. So animals who have really severe dental disease, they are stoic. Cats and dogs are very stoic. They hide their pain very well. So although you're saying, oh, yeah, I mean, he's still eating, he's doing fine, it probably is still painful when you see the teeth covered in
plaque
and like some of the teeth, like they're like some people even tell me, oh, like it's a little it moves a little, but it's gonna be okay. And like he is probably like quote unquote okay, but if you could prevent that from happening, extractions cost a lot more money than just cleaning their teeth very quickly. And like, yes, it is putting them under anesthesia, but the nice thing is most of them, if you keep good dental hygiene, like with there's water additives. If you can brush their teeth, that's the best. There's also dental treats. And I mean, just doing those things will help delay how often you have to do it. But just plan to be to do it. And like, so start saving some money. Because
for
that
the annual cleanings.
Yeah, for the annual cleanings. I think it's worth it. Your pet will be happier. You won't smell their bad breath, that you'll be happier when they kiss you and things like that. But it's hard. Like, I think trying to think baths are normal. Like giving them oatmeal baths can help remove debris and remove bacteria that they might have gotten on them.
So what, there's like shampoo based with oatmeal based shampoo?
Yeah, oatmeal based shampoo. There are medicated shampoos you could get from your vet if you need, you know, if they're like having a infection, honestly, I feel like oatmeal shampoo soothing is really nice. I'm trying to think of what the other common that we can do from home is like, it's like just a, honestly, feeding a higher quality of food.
Okay.
Is probably the smallest thing you can do and it will make a huge impact.
So from a financial aspect, what's a realistic cost for like a 20 pound bag? Of a whatever brand, but like of a high quality,
let's say food.
Kibble.
Yeah. And that's like the hard part, like Purina, like the top three brands of food that I recommend are Hill's, which is like the science diet, Purina, Pro Plan, or honestly any Purina brand would be good. And Royal Canin. And I would say for like a 20 pound bag, you're probably in the 30s. So it's like not cheap.
No, I'm paying 70.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So what are you eating?
Abady from New York. Abady. She doesn't have the brick and mortar anymore, but Marcia at For Dog's Sake.
Awesome.
So it's like an online store now, but she still imports from New York. And yeah. She has so much integrity as far as like what's best for your dog, right?
Yeah.
And then a friend recommended Darwin's for raw food.
Okay,
so
raw
food. So we get it like shipped, like delivered every month.
Okay, so you feed raw?
It's a mix of both, mostly raw. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I don't personally recommend raw food, but I know vets who do. I think it's just whatever really works for your pet is probably what's best for them. But
I guess what's a normal stool size? Because
stool size?
When I say stool size, I guess when someone was trying to explain fiber.
Yes.
To me.
Yes.
How important is fiber to, let's say a dog's diet? I'm not too familiar with cats, but like a dog's diet.
I mean, it's important.
Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely helps keep normal, consistent.
Yeah.
Just like with humans. You want a fiber, like a high fiber
I guess the
diet.
What I was told is like they have a shorter tract.
Yeah.
They don't need as much fiber.
Okay.
No, I appreciate this.
No,
And so I think a lot of at least what I was previously using had more fiber than what I'm currently using. And like, so if I'm noticing more stool, it does that show me that they're not absorbing as much from the kibble?
No. I mean, I think it really depends. Like, okay. And I mean, I'm not a veterinary nutritionist, so like,
okay.
No, I'm
open-minded to everything.
Yeah.
Right?
And like, I think it definitely depends on the animal. So there's certain diseases too that I would feed different diets to.
What do you mean diseases?
Like kidney disease. Like I'm going to offer a different diet. Oh. Like we want different protein, like concentrate, like high protein, low protein. There's very, like there's some differences there.
Sure.
Fiber is not one that I've really openly gone into and like kind of parsed out. I think it's more about the quality of the ingredients that are in there. The reason why I say I don't do raw is because of the human aspect too of like just raw meat has Salmonella, E. coli. That causes, like the dogs, yes, they technically can process that better, but there is a lot higher chance that you can get E. coli or Salmonella by handling the food, but also like when they lick you or do anything like that. And I've also seen dogs who just end up having soft stool and diarrhea, and it's probably because there's a higher presence of those in their gut flora.
I think, but anytime you're migrating diets, right? It's a slow,
It's a slower transition. Yeah. And you want to work on that. And so when I say like, I recommend those brands of food because I like the research that's behind them. So like with any pet food, I tell my like clients, my family, anyone, it's really about for me looking at the bag, the AFCO statement, every single bag has to have one. It will say if the food is formulated, which means that they just took the recommendations and the food is formulated to meet the needs of the animal versus there was a feeding trial.
Okay.
And that means that they had fed this diet for at least a certain amount of time on live animals and they know what's going to happen.
Okay.
So like I say, if it was me, I'd go after the feeding trials because you just never know. There's a lot of novel proteins and things that are added to diets to help dogs who have some mild food sensitivities and whatnot. And like, so back in the day, someone tried to introduce kangaroo meat, thought it was going well, ended up killing some dogs because it actually really messed up their kidneys. But because it was formulated, the trial, like no one knew. And so it passes all the tests that you need to. But then people who are feeding their pets, it happened after like 3 months or something. Wow. So I just that makes me nervous.
How long ago was that?
That was a while ago. Because I learned about it in school. So like it was in the, 2000s.
What about like paying attention to ingredients? Are there certain things that are misconceiving?
On food bags, there are some things that are regulated what they have to say and some things that are not. Personally, do not feed grain-free diets.
Okay.
It's been connected within the last couple years, leading to dilated cardiomyopathy, which is a heart condition. Basically, the walls become really thin and the heart gets larger. Oof. And it's bad. That's not good.
From a grain-free diet.
Yeah, so something with, and it was certain diets and it was certain things. And they it's not like 100% like every single grain-free diet.
Sure.
But it is a majority of grain-free diets. And I say, why risk it?
Yeah.
When we're still trying to figure out what actually is missing.
That's wild.
So they don't know if it's because it's missing like taurine and then you could supplement taurine and still feed. But there's like, and like Tufts Veterinary Nutrition is where I would send people.
Can you spell that?
Tufts, T-U-F-T-S.
Okay.
It's the veterinary school.
Oh, okay.
I think
okay.
What's
the negative outlook on grains?
It's just a certain type of grains that they don't know why, but it's the way it reacts with animal.
But were grains causing harm to certain animals? Like why take it out from a diet?
Exactly. It was a human thing.
Oh.
there was really not a real reason, you know, like we became really like grain free, like the human side. So like we have to think about that.
It's not how all applicable our, to
like, no, like, like, and that's like the same reason like vegetarianism and veganism, like cats cannot be vegan. Mm-hmm. They are obligate carnivores. Mm-hmm. They cannot be vegetarian. Like they need meat in order to survive. Dogs are more omnivorous, so maybe they can survive on a vegetarian diet. But it's like we end up, humans end up, what's that word? I can't think of it, but when we put our own feelings
imposing
onto,
or
yeah, it's like amorph. I can't think of how you say it, but you know, we put our own feelings, our own beliefs on the animal, and like we just can't do that all the time. It's not safe for them. So really grain free, I mean, as far as my understanding, just came from, oh, well, people are starting to be grain free, we'll just make a grain free diet for dogs.
Sure.
They can continue that.
Sure. That's wild.
I know, yeah. That's my understanding. Maybe there is a difference, but so I definitely say like don't do grain free, and I look for feeding trials. But feeding a high quality diet can help. Because like when you eat good, you feel good.
Yeah.
It's just like with humans, you know, what we put in our bodies matters as well. And it can help prevent diseases, but it could also just help keep their skin and coat healthy and things like that.
At the moment, is there anything that you're excited about One Tail at a Time that they're working on, or that what you guys are working on?
Yeah, definitely lots of things. Right now we have a big Adopt a Large Breed Dog campaign going on. So we have adoptions waived for some of our large breed dogs, because right now that is the most vulnerable population in animal shelters, meaning that they're most likely going to be the ones euthanized. And of course, we're doing our best to take in as many as we can, but they are harder to get adopted and harder to place. And that's because of breed restrictions and things like that. But so it's really exciting to have that campaign and to be really trying our best to get those dogs adopted, but then also just get more exposure for them. And then with our Pet Mutual Aid program, we have a large grant from PetSmart Charities, which is going to help us bring access to care to the South Side of Chicago. So we're really excited for that partnership. It's just getting going. So
in what way, like how, like another clinic or like,
just we're going to be talking to the neighborhood and finding out what they need. So we don't want to impose our beliefs on them. We want to hear from them and let them decide kind of what do they need? What kind of resources are they looking for? I'm sure. Well, at least I think, some of it will be veterinary care. I think there's going to be behavior grooming. And so we're going to try and find our ways where we can help fit and fill some gaps that they need. We just have a lot of really big things coming up that I'm not allowed to talk about
yet.
I almost really feel it a secret. Let me be quiet before I get in trouble.
My father-in-law really wants to put a golf tournament together with One Tail as the receiving.
Oh my gosh, amazing.
Charity.
Yes, please. And if they need a dog to come, you let us know.
Okay.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, and like, I mean, I think that's the beauty of One Tail too, that I just didn't get at some of the other places I got, is like the community of One Tail is really incredible. The volunteers, the fosters.
Do you guys know Joel Holland?
I do.
From
not.
One Corner. It's I like a real not. Estate group. They I don't know. I've seen the partnership before.
Oh, amazing. Okay. I might not know him. I'm sure somebody else does though. Yeah.
How important has social media been? As far as like just sharing the dogs that are available, that
it's so important.
That might, you know, need help.
Yeah, it's very important, because word of mouth is really how people find out about everything. And and finding out from your friend about something, you're more likely going to trust it. And so like even just sharing our stories, or sharing our fundraisers or anything like that is what really helps us continue to do what we're doing. Social media is just kind of incredible. I think our marketing team is is going to start having me do some TikTok, so it should be very interesting.
Glad you're open-minded to them.
Yeah. I try to be a good sport. I do my best. Yeah. I try to be a good sport.
Well, I'm sure you have your own ideas of, like, let's, like, the, even just the chat that we talked about like preventative things that you can do at home. Like, I think that goes a long way.
And
I think
true.
People want these resources and knowledge on what to do.
Yeah, like just talk to a vet. Yeah.
Right.
We had on One Tail, we have a little YouTube profile as well. Like, there's definitely some talks on there. I think I talked about like what to do if your dog ate something.
Sure.
You know, like, and it really is like the small things, like what are the poisonous foods that you just don't know it's toxic to your dog?
Right.
Like onions and garlic. Don't give that to your dog, you know, like, but people don't know. I mean, I didn't know until I was a vet. I was I definitely did some of this when I was younger.
Yeah. Oops. Yeah.
It's and a quick luckily Google my search, dog is great.
Right.
Steel stomach. But.
In the unfortunate instance where a dog, maybe even a cat, goes into cardiac arrest, like what could a pet parent or a bystander do for them?
Yeah. So there are like CPR courses that you can take. There's some online. I think Anti-Cruelty Society also used to do an in-person class. I'm not sure if they're still doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was before the pandemic. But yeah, you can learn pet CPR.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to explain, so I'm not going to try to do that.
If we were to try to, I mean, the pet is on their side. And are we going on the upper half of their chest,
so their heart sits, like if you took their elbow, mm-hmm. you would bend it.
Mm-hmm.
That's where their heart is going to sit. So
I like that
kind of helps. You could at least know to do that.
Is this what we're doing?
Yeah. So
we're not compressing on the side of their chest.
So there, it depends on the size of the animal.
Ah, good. Okay. Okay.
So that's the hard part.
Gotcha.
Because if you have a very large dog, yes, you're going to be compressions because that's more size, more like a human. If you have like a small cat or you're just using your fingers.
Yeah. And then if you could attribute it to the rate to a rhythm, rate to a song, is it similar to a human rate? Kind of like staying alive, 120 beats per minute?
Yeah, I would say yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I know in human CPR, we're like, just do hands only CPR. Don't worry about doing mouth to mouth because you're only given 16% oxygen into this human by breathing mouth to mouth, unless you had a bag valve mask device.
Yeah, I would say that's
similar
about
with
the same.
Pet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But you can, if you wanted to, you cover and you
hold
go through
hold
the nose.
Snout and then mm-hmm. go through the nose.
But yeah, it's probably more important to get that heart going.
Okay.
And the compressions.
All right.
Yeah.
What about, this is just from like a friend's experience, like recognizing maybe even a seizure.
Yes, seizures. They're very scary when they happen.
What could someone do if they didn't have medication?
So if you don't have like medication, that's going to like rescue medication.
Like first time. Yeah.
You want to, you stay, cause they will bite. They can bite you.
Gotcha.
So you want to stay away. You kind of want to do the same kind of like with a person. You want to keep them away from anything that they could fall and hurt themselves. But you usually let them wait. I would take a video of it happening and I would start a timer.
Gotcha.
Cause that's the information your vet is going to need when they come, when you bring them in. And I'm talking more about like status
epilepsy. Yeah. Like a prolonged seizure.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, I mostly say like you try to remove anything. If they have anything in their mouth, you do your best to grab it, but just stay away because they can bite you.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you just have to wait, unfortunately.
Yeah, as with humans.
Yeah, I was like, it's not too much you can do, and it is scary to see. But starting a seizure log and like really kind of measuring the time and stuff is really going to help your vet make decisions, treatment decisions and things like that.
In your experience, are there common triggers for seizures?
Not that we know of.
Interesting.
Or at least not that I know of. Maybe the neurologist might tell you something different, but I will say like, I would see, like if you can remember what your dog was doing or your cat was doing before
Super
the
helpful,
seizure,
yeah.
That is helpful because there are like things that look like seizures but are not. So like syncope, like fainting episodes. And those typically can happen after they vomit, or like a vagal response, it kind of is, or like after taking a poop or something where they're straining. And it can look the same where they might, oh, and then fall over and then come back. And then how do they act after the episode? Yeah. Because
that'll distinguish it.
That can also help distinguish, like, are they disoriented or are they right back to normal? Usually after a seizure, we would expect some disorientation and things like that. But yeah, it kind of depends. And it does kind of depend on if we can figure out the cause of the seizure. So I don't know if, like, for like idiopathic epilepsy, if there's like triggers, like I know flashing lights in humans and things like that. I don't know if we pinpointed something like that, but there are like bacterias and viruses and things like that that can cause seizures that we would look for too. So like if that happened to you, I usually say let's do some blood work so we can make sure it's not like an electrolyte imbalance or something to that sense, where it's like something we can treat and then hopefully
not happen again.
Yeah. But if it is idiopathic epilepsy, so that means we don't know the cause.
Okay.
Then that's when it would be kind of like, okay, how frequently are we having it? Then do we start medicine? Do we not start medicine? And things like that.
What about absence seizures?
Those are harder to diagnose. Yeah.
Whole video recording is helpful.
It does help. Yeah. So
yeah.
If you notice that, like, fly snapping, so like if your dog just starts like kind of like snapping in the air, looks like he's looking for flies or like trying to catch a fly.
Okay.
That's usually a sign.
Wow.
Sometimes if they're licking the floor a lot, like I don't want to say some of these things because I'm like, some of it is very normal behavior.
Some of this is very normal behavior.
So do not think we are just having a seizure. But yeah, there are some, like, things that they just do that are very small and subtle that could be seizures.
Sure.
Usually you'll see some other signs and things like that. So, but yes, like anxiety can look like absent seizures as well.
Really?
Yeah. Like, so licking the floor, licking your paws constantly, that could be an anxious behavior as well. Or the dog's just bored.
Right.
Or allergies, you know, like, so like it's hard to say, but fly snapping, I feel like, is a good one.
Do you see like a unilateral stare as well?
You can.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Awesome. If a pre-vet student is listening, I guess what, you know, at this point in time, if you were to do it all over again, per se, but like what should they be looking forward to? What should they be aware of? Any advice for them?
Yeah. Definitely, I think finding a mentor, finding someone you can talk to who's in the field, and just going out and actually shadowing a veterinarian, I think, is really important. So you could kind of, and do it like multiple times. And if you don't particularly like that mentor, you can find a new one and see, you know, someone who's going to support you. I think having support is really, really important to help you get through the field. And then just trying different parts of the field. Don't limit yourself so early on in your career where you just become very rigid and that's the only thing I'm going to do. But kind of diversify your experience. Like, oh, are you interested in zoo animals? Like, try and find something you could do with them.
Gotcha.
Oh, okay. Like, definitely get that clinical experience because you're going to go through clinics regardless. So the earlier you get exposed to it, regardless of what kind of veterinarian you want to be at the end, you will have to complete clinics to get there. But you know, finding that those other opportunities, talking to like a veterinary radiologist if you can find one, attending career fairs, and like use like networking is really important, I guess.
Okay.
And like utilizing the people who want to help you. I wish I would have done it more.
When you were doing the shadowing, like, was it easy to find someone like that? Because I felt like, in as far as being a pre-med, I didn't have family or neighbors around, right?
I didn't have.
Could you just walk into like a clinic or a shelter?
Sometimes you have to do the cold call. Yeah, sometimes you might have to do that cold call. You know, like, I mean, it's not like in my family I had a veterinarian who would be like, "Yeah, go become, you know, like my mom's best friend. But maybe talking, like if you have a pet, go to some of the visits.
Right, right.
And then maybe talk to the vet that you who's your pet's vet.
Yeah.
I mean, if I, like at the career fair, I told the students, like, if you want to come talk to me, like, I'm happy to talk with you. I've had some high school students reach out through, like, a different program. It's from a volunteer at One Tail. And they're like, hey, would you mind talking to a student who's interested in this field? And, I'm like, yes. And so, like, you could come email me. You could DM me on Instagram. And we could try and find some time to talk. You know, even if it's just a phone call, just so you can hear what a real experience is like. Mm-hmm. And just don't be afraid.
Yeah.
And it's okay if you don't want to do this field. Like, not be a vet. Like, it's okay if you, like, do you really want to work with animals or do you really want to be a veterinarian? Like, there's other career opportunities where you can work with animals and do all these amazing things. And you don't have to be the vet either. So you don't have to give up on that dream.
Yeah. I guess, how was your time at Brookfield? Like, just handling all those?
Yeah. So I worked with the nutrition department at Brookfield.
Wow. Okay.
And it was not, I like applied to just be an intern for the summer. And I was hoping I would be in the primates because I just really like primates. But I got put in the nutrition department and I was like, blessing in disguise.
Now, is that, now you did nutrition for all the animals?
Yeah. So I was like, this is kind of better. Like, I don't know. I was like, I don't know what I expected. But it was very interesting to be able to see. Like, so part of my time there, I've spent more with the nutritionist. And she had me do some research. She had me come up with, like, a research question that she had.
Wow.
And I worked with, like, the Asian small clawed otters. And so apparently otters have bad dental disease.
Oh.
Who would have thought? Not me. And so what we did was we were trying to see if we gave them dehydrated salmon skin, if they liked it, if it helped like break up tartar to help like with their dental health, like as treats. So kind of like dental treats, like with dogs and cats that we've come up with. And so that was really exciting to like, I gave them like I came up with like my own little research thing for that. And then another project she had me work on was with the lions. And it was creating a more realistic diet, like how they feed. So in the wild, predatory animals, carnivores especially, like they don't really eat like the same amount every single day.
Mm.
Like usually they have one big, large day where they eat about 80% of their calories for the week.
Mm.
And then the rest of the day they're just picking because it's usually like one big hunt.
Mm.
You can't always, you're not hunting every single day. And so it was fun to kind of figure out a way where we can mimic that more in the zoo. Because of course, like in the zoo, usually you're getting a normal meal once a day and going like that. So it was just fun. It was interesting to learn. And then the second part of my time with the program, I was actually preparing the meals that, and then we would deliver them to the whole zoo.
That's awesome.
And so it was like, I found out what they feed the little cockroaches that they have, you know, like the bugs they have at the zoo.
Oh,
like what do they feed these? What do they feed the dolphins? You know, it was really interesting.
Wow.
And yeah, and it was fun. It was like, who would have thought I would end up there? But I just wanted, you know, it was worth it.
Without, you know, hating on zoos too much, like, do zoos have a place in our world? Is it bittersweet?
It's bittersweet to me.
Like, or people not understanding the conservationism and the work. Like,
Yes, and there are definitely some bad places that need to be closed down.
Okay.
But I do think it's hard. Like, yes, do I wish these animals were in these areas and like in these small environments, you know?
Yeah.
No. Have we learned so much more about them and able to help with conservation because of zoos? Yes. And then I also think about people who can never travel, who can't go see them in their wild. Like, I've never
been
to
safari,
Africa,
you know,
like now they have an opportunity to see these animals in person and learn about them. I mean, I think that's something too. Like the access is kind of nice.
You don't hear that. I mean, so at UIC, I used to check fire extinguishers.
Yeah.
And we would go to any building on campus. They had an animal lab on campus, and it was always awful. Like hearing the beagles is shrieking, mm-hmm. and there were chimps and orangutans down there, and starkly different from a zoo. They're just in a cage, and it's like.
And we work with a research lab. We help. We take their retired beagles.
Yeah,
and at One Tail, and we adopt them.
I'm not saying there's mistreatment. I guess it's just like you empathize with the situation, and
it's hard.
The amount of knowledge that this animal is helping us understand, I hope goes unnoticed, right?
And I mean, research is so hard. It's so hard.
Like the ethics of it, right?
Yeah, it's. I mean, even seeing like the beagles we get, like I know, especially with having a research background and like how stringent rules have to be in order, like they go through, it's called IACUC. It's a overseeing board to make sure that things are ethical and like that things are not getting mistreated. And yes, there are some research that I'm like, do we really need to know this answer? No.
Mm.
And maybe those are the ones that I'm like, do we have to do that? Mm. But then you know, like if we really think about all the medicine and all the like cancer treatments, or it's like they are finding out ways to help people every day because of the research they do on animals. And there's just not a different
vessel right now
that we can use, and it is hard to say like we shouldn't do that.
Yeah,
it is very hard to say we shouldn't be doing this. And like I have some of my friends who are lab animal veterinarians who oversee a lot of these labs and making sure that these animals are well taken care of.
Yeah,
and in those situations I'm like, yeah, I would not think these people are unethical in any way. I mean, it's hard. I get the fights between the two sides, but at the same time, I'm like, if it's for the greater good, then I feel better about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, our partnership, like I'm very grateful for the lab that we work with.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was employees there, and like, I think that's a big misconception, is that the employees who work with these animals do not care about these animals.
Mm.
And I think that's the furthest thing from the truth.
Mm.
An employee there worked very hard to be able to figure out a way to get these retired beagles out and be able to be adopted.
Yeah.
When beforehand, I mean, I would assume the only other
option
was euthanasia after, you know. Because there are rules. There are certain rules that you cannot do certain things to lab animals. And so I think you have to think about the people who are doing the work as well and who are making a difference in these animals' lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because with any research, you know, with anything, I mean, it's polarizing. It is a controversial topic in animal welfare and all of that.
It was my first time. We were doing diabetes research on mice and rats, but it was my first time being exposed to larger animals. But like a dog, it's just like,
you don't
research
see it.
On dogs?
Yeah.
You do.
You do. And like primates.
Yeah.
Like, and they're, I mean, pretty sentient. Like,
they were bigger than me.
Yeah, you know. So, it is interesting, and it is hard. It's it is. I haven't directly worked in like a lab where I was like, with the animal being right in front of me and things like that. I don't know how I would do.
But we would assume that they're not heartless.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think when we go on these like. Oh, we gotta shut them down, like, you are terrible, and like, you pick it outside, and just, it's like, come on.
Yeah.
Let's think about the people who are behind
this, too. I think, those people behind on the day-to-day are picking their battles, too.
They're picking their battles, too, and like, I think we just need to find a way to help, and so like, that's like my goal, is it's not to pass judgment, but to help. Okay, you're here now. What can we do now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was great. Is there anything that we haven't chimed in or talked about?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, unless you have anything else.
No, I'm good. I mean, awesome. where can people find you?
So I'm on Instagram, dr.raywushen. Do you want me to spell it out?
Or? No, I'll put it in the show notes.
Perfect. and then Facebook, Rachel Wooten Schendel.
Okay, sounds good. Appreciate the time again.
Thank you. You can find me at One Tale at a Time.
Awesome,
so
yeah.
If we ever have an event, I'm probably going to be somewhere.
Okay,
so
sounds good. Yeah, well, I'll be in touch. Thanks for mentioning that. You can have a dog. I didn't know that.
But
my father-in-law, he's so excited. He wanted to create this like shirts for the group.
Absolutely.
And like the it's gonna be a paw with a like a golf hole and a flag coming out of it.
Amazing.
Yeah, something like that. So it's like wow, I am down for
amazing. Yeah, I mean, you let us know, like, the individual fundraisers, we are all over those.
Okay.
And if you need help, there's like an associate board that helps
Sounds
you
good.
And do all these things. So yeah, just let us know if we can help more. But yeah, if you want animals there and it's allowed, I'm sure we can make that happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll be in touch.
That's exciting.
Everyone else, thanks for tuning in. Until then, stay curious.